Good afternoon, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. I think it's wonderfully courageous of you to come again today, in fact, because we had such a hard time yesterday, but I hope that that problem has been got over and we can have a proper, hopefully, a conversation too, which is what we need about this very unfamiliar stuff. Now, Siegfried, am I heard now, everybody? Siegfried was the great hero of the Germanic world, in which C.G. Jung himself grew up. And just before the beginning of the First World War, he had that vision of a sea of blood covering Europe and rising to the peaks of the Alps. And then another dream in which he knew that he must kill Siegfried, in the way that one knows sometimes in a dream what one's got to do. One must kill Siegfried. He was assisted by a small, dark, primitive man, a wild man, a savage. Now, the World War hadn't broken out when he had that dream. Nobody expected it to. When, in about 8 months later, it suddenly broke out, he realized that it was about the world. As well as himself, he thought it was just about himself. Maybe he was going mad or something, and he had to kill the hero in him to stop himself going mad. But he realized that it was a thing being played out in the world as well as in his own psyche. You know what academics are like, don't you? What a shark pit it is. And he had been in the shark pit for 10 or 12 years and been very successful. But he didn't want to go out like that. His own need was to do something different. And so he had this dream. And he also had those very accurate presentiments about what was happening. It's what the psyche does, you see, a sort of weird intuition we all have, and some of us more than others, about what the real problem of the world is. Now, the dream was like this. I was with an unknown brown-skinned man, a savage, in a lonely, rocky landscape. It was before dawn, and the eastern sky was already light and stars fading. Then I heard Siegfried's horn sounding over the mountains, and I knew that we had to kill him. The dream continues. They were armed with rifles, and they waited for Siegfried by a narrow path over the rocks. Then he appeared high on the crest of the mountain in the first ray of the rising sun. On a chariot made of the bones of dead men, he rode at a furious pace down the precipitous slope. Then they fired, and he plunged down, struck dead. The dreamer was filled with guilt and horror, because the hero is a beautiful figure. But a downfall of rain followed, and he knew that all would be washed clean. Now, of course, Siegfried wasn't killed. He was still very much alive in the Second World War. The tank commander in Normandy, who knocked out 8 inferior Allied tanks with his great long gun, said he felt exactly like Siegfried. So he's psychologically very alive. And of course, I think he still is. But the world wants something different now. When he woke, he realized that he'd had to understand the stream. He had to understand it. He had no understanding of it. It blocked him. And I think many of these sorts of ideas will be blocking you because they're so unfamiliar to us. It was a matter of life and death that he understood it. He couldn't. It was like his childhood dream of God's turd. I don't know if any of you have read much his memories, dreams. But he had this awful dream when he was a child that God was sitting up and a great turd was descending on the Cathedral of Basel. And he couldn't grasp its meaning for 7 or 8 days, and he thought, God, I've got to, I'm going mad. And then he eventually did. He realized that there was something about the Christianity which was being rejected. And this dream was like it. There was a block in the mind. It lasted for some days. For indeed, to understand it would be the end of a whole mental world and the beginning of something completely new and unknown. And then, quite suddenly, it was obvious. He saw, he says in memory's dreams, that it was his dream and his Siegfried. And he only, but also something being played out in the world. And he only knew for sure when the war, which would destroy all the great empires, and they were all heroic things, leaving only the British itself mortally wounded, a clear sweep of the old imperial culture. What was really happening? Siegfried represented the German will to achieve heroically, to impose their will, to have their way. And they were faced by the French, British, Russians, who were saying much the same thing. The whole culture was saying it. The whole culture was turning on itself. It was an act of self-destruction, that first war. And he, Jung, knew that he had tried to achieve in that way too. The dream showed him that the heroic attitude embodied by Siegfried, he said, no longer suited me. And so it had to be killed. Now, the question for us, and it's why I'm giving these lectures, is whether the heroic attitude any longer suits any of us, either personally or as part of a world civilization. The dream of killing Siegfried is moving everywhere, and it moved within Jung, who was a pathfinder, as people like him are. All these efforts at peace and reconciliation and other ways of solving things than by power, all these efforts to set up a viable democratic mode of government and so that we don't have to have dictators, all that's about somehow getting rid of the hero as a dominant archetype. If we could encapsulate Jung's life, work, in a single image, I think it would be the killing of Siegfried. You see, these first lines of the poem which I quoted yesterday, in a sense, say it all. Surpassing all kings. Got to be bigger than other people. Powerful and tall, beyond all others. The hero always goes beyond. He always has to break every possible record. Violent, splendid, a wild bull of a man, unvanquished leader, fortress, they call him, hero in the front lines, beloved by soldiers, protector of the people, raging flood that destroys all defenses, that is to say, on the attack too. Psychologically, the hero myth is the emergence into history of the human ego in a specifically male sense, in that it has to gather power, physical power, in order to make a way, make out from the mothering culture, the mothering nature which has nurtured it. A woman's power is a bit different. This is specifically male power. And it's the entry into the human story of power as a player itself in evolution. It breaks out of nature's control I was talking yesterday of the way in which Hitler wanted to kill nature in his soldiers, so they wouldn't be bothered by mercy and kindness when they were killing the Jews, for example. It was the breakout of the whole system of nature. And it not only breaks out of nature's power, but it breaks out of her protection. That wonderful, blessed homeostatic system by which everything is kept in a system of balance, unless you try and break it, in which all things are balanced by their opposites and also, as it were, held in check. As the heat in our bodies is limited by the cold and the violence and destruction of the winter storm is limited by the sweetness of the spring morning which follows it, and the sweetness by the returning gales of the autumn. A system in which all living creatures are held in a web of instinct, which is most interesting the more we know about it, in which the predator kills as much as he needs to eat and no more. There are very few exceptions to that, and there's been usually, where there is, when a fox gets in and kills 50 chickens, it's usually because they're flapping around and everything. It's a human situation. In nature, it doesn't happen. And the prey know it in the way that animals do know things, which is not the same as us. And the antelope will graze within sight of the lion's feast, because for a while now, he's safe. And perhaps most interestingly of all, the wolf will fight another wolf up to the death, but never beyond. For he knows that he need only show his throat, his most vulnerable part, for the other wolf to be absolutely barred by instinct from touching him. It is a wonderfully rational system, and it's not made by us. It's nature's rationality. The thus precedence, you see, is established. You need to have precedence. You will need to know who's stronger than who in a wolf pack. But the wolf doesn't, the pack doesn't lead, lose a wolf. The idea that nature is a chaos until put in order by our wonderful selves is a sort of pathetic fallacy. Sadly, a pathetic hallmark of the hero attitude, because it's always the hero who thinks he's got to tidy things up, put them in order. And actually, nature knows so much better. The word rational, of course, comes from Latin ratio, which means ratio, measure, proportion. And nature does it to perfection. All its parts are held between two rules. The first is that all plants and creatures should grow as fully as they can into themselves. That's what Aristotle called the telos, the end in the sense of purpose in the beginning. And the other is that they shouldn't go beyond it. The second rule is that having reached your full proportion and measure, you should stay there. And that's what animals do, but that's what we often don't. We push on. And then nature strikes at us, as it always does at the hero. For if, like an organ in a body, if the kidney grows beyond itself, it becomes a cancer and it destroys the whole. And it's like that with anything in nature which gets out of proportion with its place in nature. Nature moves itself to destroy it. Heraclitus, who is the great philosopher of nature, he was a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher. That is to say, he came before Plato and Aristotle. And his book was called The Book of Nature. Since Plato and Aristotle, we have been interested much more in intellect than nature. They've got a different sort of logic. He spoke about the logos in a different way. It was the way that things hang together, in fact. But he said, in one of those wonderfully compressed sentences, if the sun outstep his limits, the theories, those ministers of justice, will find him out. And it's a wonderful thing, you say it about the sun, and of course it applies to the whole of the cosmos. The Erinyes, the Furies were the Erinyes in Greek myth, and they were female gods of earth, also called the Furies, and they avenged all wrongs done to nature. And nature's great rule, of course, is limit, measure, proportion. If you find, I always think I might talk about this at the end if I have time. Macbeth is the great study of the hero in our literature, in English literature. He outstepped every possible rule. And you see the whole world, as it were, gathering together to destroy him. And it was somewhat like that with the Nazi, with Hitler. The whole world had together before it had to get together to destroy it, but it did. The whole vastly complex organism of nature depends on our knowing what our limit is. It depends on a sort of deep humility, not a humble, but it's a very difficult word to use that. But Jung talks a lot about inflation, the danger of thinking you're more than you are. You have to know what you are, live up to what you are, you have to know where you stop. To outstep one's bounds, says Heraclitus, attracts the attention of the Furies. And I think that's really the tragedy of the hero myth, the hero archetype, the hero ideal, because for 5,000 years, the Furies have raged. Therefore, I think, for me, the most representative figure of the human hero is that very poor young man, Actaeon, who got torn to pieces by his own hands. More representative than the great monster slayers like Hercules and Beowulf and Theseus. Because he broke that cardinal rule of the hunt, that you kill what you need to kill. And the whole of nature depends on that. And then you stop. They thought that he was struck down because he saw Artemis naked in her pool. Many people have interpreted it in that way. I didn't believe a word of it. It wasn't all that unnatural for a young man to look at a goddess in a pool. But I'll tell you the story. He's flagrantly broken that rule by which nature lives. And Artemis is the goddess of nature, so she's going to defend it. Actaeon has gone hunting with his mates in the forest. Eventually they stop for a rest. As Ovid describes it, who is the source of most of these stories, their nets, spears, and their swords, their very bodies are caked with the blood of the animals they have slain. And they are feeling very chuffed about this. And he says to them, we'll just have a little rest and then we'll start again. And he wanders off into the wood, perhaps to find a stream to wash in. And it is then that he comes across Artemis in her bath and is turned into a stag, and his own hounds devour him. And two of Titian's last and greatest paintings are about this, and some of you may know them. And you can read the conventional interpretation in any history of art. They all say that Actaeon is completely innocent, and the gods that strike him down are cruel. It's the cruelty of the gods. And that is the sort of stereotype of our culture, that there's nothing wrong with what we've done. We're just victims of the cruelty of the gods. It's an evasion of responsibility. And that's we are to the gods, cries King Lear, do you remember, as frogs to as frogs to wanton boys. Wonderful. They kill us for their sport. And no figure in all literature, of course, as much as Lear, but himself precisely in that position. And Shakespeare certainly knew that. Now, maybe you see, if you hunt, you get hunted. If you hunt irreverently, you will be hunted. And that is the sort of natural justice of nature. And maybe nature's nakedness, in fact, her inmost secret, is just that which we cannot take, because it puts responsibility onto us. Maybe that's the naked truth, for that would be consciousness, moral consciousness. So as a culture, we do everything to avoid it. We blame it on nature. We blame it on the enemy, an enemy, any old enemy, a neighbor. We blame it on some hapless minority in the country. We blame it on any other race, especially if it looks very different to ourselves. And we think we need a hero, a savior, who will save us from this dreadful chaos, which is ourselves. And there are lots who offer to do so. If you, any of you, stood up in the marketplace and you said, I know it all, I'm it, I know, you'd get lots of people following you. And not only would they follow you, they might even start demanding that you be that savior. It's a terrible thing in human nature, and it makes it very easy for the petty dictators that swarm now in the corpse, of course, of the ancient empires. The Saddam Husseins, the Ceausescus, the Gaddafis, and so many, many more. That wonderful thing, whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. The Furies work on that level. And we know that if the dictator isn't mad at the beginning, Mugabe, of course, is another case, he infallibly is mad at the end. And usually a ghastly end like Gaddafi's. The Furies work on that level. It's interesting that Lady Macbeth, Shakespeare knew all about this, who was the most rationalist and logical of the pair, was the first one to go mad, the first one to crack. But with the weapons we have now, dictators are the single major threat to the world. Now, the historical Gilgamesh was one of the first kings of Uruk, which was the largest of a group of cities, an amazingly vast city. Back in 3200 BC, before the kings came, a city covering more space than any other would be until the great days of Rome. When they built the wall, and Gilgamesh was alleged to have built the wall, it ran for 6 miles. 6 miles of urban culture. 3300 BC, let's say. There arose in the lower basin of the Tigris and Euphrates an potentially immensely fertile basin. Around the beginning of the 5th millennium BC, that is to say 5000 BC, that's when the temples were founded in the various cities. That is 7000 years ago. The dynastic period, that is when the kings, like Gilgamesh, arose, began in Sumer and in Egypt at the same time, about 3000 BC. So there's something happened which changed the world around the end of the 4th millennium. And it was in response to serious invasions from the east. And we don't know to what extent our own culture of that age the culture that made Stonehenge and the stone lines and those wonderful tumuli and passage tombs. A wonderful culture who knew all about the stars, as the Sumerians did too, and thought a lot about their buildings and made statements in their buildings which we are still trying to decipher. We don't know to what extent similar invasions wiped them out, but they certainly dropped at about the same time. Those buildings went out of use at about in about 3000 BC. This means that the agrarian cultures of the Neolithic world, which I found enormously interesting, that had developed for thousands of years without kings and leaders, became suddenly utterly dependent upon them. And then, when you have a ruler, something mysterious happens throughout the culture. The horizontal lines of relationship between equal people suddenly switch into vertical lines, where everything comes down from the top. All honor and authority comes down from the top. And every individual is, as it were, sucked out of their responsibilities, sucked out and placed at the top. It's a profound change which goes right through the society. And I think that some of us, me certainly, remember the time when our society was definitely vertical. And now, of course, after 50 years of peace, it's becoming much more horizontal. And how much more creative and pleasant it is. Certainly creative. The pharaoh, his main duty was to defend against people who they called the sea people, who were pouring in over the Nile and destroying things. And that's when they got together around a pharaoh. And that was the beginning of a long, long dynastic period where things completely changed. And the ruling model became the pyramid. I find that very interesting. With the pharaoh at the top, you see, and the great lords there, on and on, down to the common people at the bottom. And that became the model for society for throughout the coming culture. The foe came in longboats, nosing along the waterways of Mesopotamia and up the multiple channels of the Nile Delta, onto an undefended civilization. Much as later Huns, Goths, Vikings, Vandals poured through the frontiers of Europe at intervals of several centuries, sometimes down to our own day. Always from the same sources, the great steppes of Central Asia, driven west by the winters growing colder, maybe, and rumours of easy pickings in the west, because they had now trained the horses, you see, so they could travel enormously long distances very quickly. They could ride all day and sleep on the saddle. And that enormously sort of huge temptation for people brought up in very arid places of Europe, warmed by the Gulf Stream, irrigated by its rain, that long growing season of its northern climate, because it's very weirdly north, considering how fertile it is, was a huge attraction to anybody who was hungry. Western civilization started with them. And in the floodplain southwards in Mesopotamia and Egypt, it was the same story. Civilization always starts in a big river delta. All over the world you find it that the earliest civilizations were around the great rivers. But over Europe, right down, there was a farming civilization developed for 3,000 or 4,000 years since the beginning of farming, since people suddenly realized that they could work with the earth. And that partnership of people with the earth is enormously significant because it affects how they are, how they think, how they relate to each other, how they learn to fit into the pattern of nature. And it's immensely, deeply civilizing. As far as we can judge, and I'm quoting a historian now, a great historian of Sumer, called Thorkild Jacobsen. As far as we can judge, the fourth millennium and the ages before it had been moderately peaceful. Wars and raids were not unknown, but they were not constant and they did not dominate existence. In the third millennium, they appear to have become the order of the day, that is to say, after 3000 BC. No one was safe. Queens and great ladies, like their humble sisters, faced the constant possibility that might find them widowed, torn from their homes and children, and enslaved in a barbarous household. It was a high civilization that went down, and we know that from their literature. A world in which human personality had expanded as it only can in a viable civilization, expanded into a refinement of feeling. That's the key, the refinement of feeling, and you can see it in the art and pottery of that civilization. And also in their literature. Because of that marvelous invention of the damp clay tablet inscribed and then dried in the sun, we can know what it was like to be alive in that culture. We can't know what it was like to live at Stonehenge. There's no literature, you see, there's no script left. There must have been a script, I think, but it didn't survive. It was unique. And this heart-rending lament, which comes from Sumer, must stand as a requiem for a culture which stretched far beyond it. Alas, that day of mine on which I was destroyed. You will find a lot of the poetry in the Old Testament is descended from this style of poetry. Alas, that day of mine on which I was destroyed. Alas, that day of mine on which I was destroyed. For on that day he came hither to me in my house. For on it he turned in the mountains into the road to me. For on it the boat came on my river toward me. For on it heading toward me the boat moored at my quay. For on it the master of the boat came into me. For on it he reached out his dirty hands towards me. For on it he yelled to me, "Get up, get on board." For on it the goods were taken aboard in the bow. For on it I grew cold with the most shivering fear. The foe trampled with his booted feet into my chamber. The foe reached out his dirty hands towards me. The foe stripped me of my robe, clothed his wife in it. That foe cut my string of gems, hung it on his child. I myself was the tread, the walks of his abode. Now some of you may know the play by Euripides, which I might mention later, called The Women of Troy, where a band of women are on the quay in exactly that situation 2,000 years later. It was the beginning of what I call the real tragic period in human history. And whether we can put an end to it or not, I don't know. You see that Troy has been destroyed. Their husbands and sons have been killed. They're waiting on the quay. They're going to be taken off to be household slaves in the houses of the people who killed their menfolk. And it was completely normal in Greek society that should be done. That was what happened. A huge evasion of responsibility. Now, what was the difference between the foe and this advanced civilization he destroyed? Between a raider with about as little feeling as a stoat or a fox, and a civilization capable of giving such deep expression in such a lament, they seem to be almost different species. There's only one explanation. I'm going to offer it to you. You can accept it or not. It is the deepest civilizing influence of a couple of thousand years working with Earth. In yesterday's talk, I spoke about the Shamhat and Enkidu, and Enkidu coming to understand things. It's an animal that he didn't understand before. It's like that with the land. It's a deeply civilizing influence when you really get into the relationship. The invading tribes had not undergone anything like that long tutelage, which makes a civilization. That's stability too, I think. They had not performed for year after year that fundamental erotic act, because that's what it is, to put a seed into the earth and watch it grow. But that's where you have an actual partnership with the earth in the creation of nourishment. It's a profoundly important thing. They had not never produced food out of that relationship so as to have no need to hunt and kill, had not stayed in one place long enough to do that. And if one asks, well, can it really be as simple as that? I can't see anything else. These were herding people following the grass and the migrations of the buck, drinking their horses' blood, depending very much on a rather sparse hunting, not at all farmers, skilled in the art of horse riding and weaponry, related to the environment essentially as predators, and in that sense parasites, for they had never created nourishment out of themselves, out of the partnership of themselves. And incidentally, when we talk about work with your own psyche, it's very much on that analogy, you know, that if you get to work with yourself, with your own unconscious soil, it is transformative. It's wonderfully creative, and it is the making of consciousness. So partnership with the inner earth can be parallel to the partnership with the outer earth. And it is a maturing experience to create something with something else. It makes you grow up. In the aristocratic cultures that followed, and which we have only just coming out of, down to our end time, it was honourable to hunt, honourable to conquer, honourable to steal, and it was not honourable to be a peasant and produce soil from the earth. You took it off the peasants. It's very difficult for us to take it in. That's why I'm telling you all these obvious things, which we sort of have taken for granted, that it was just how the world is. It's not how the world is. It's a particular culture. Yet we see how that passionate relationship that a woman makes with her garden and a man with the fields around his earth, or his garden, it's a development of the heart. It includes an enormous amount of stuff coming in. And a true civilization rises out of it. It is a coming of age of the human in relation to the earth. And it's not a coming of age over of victories over subject peoples. It's an initiation, a new relationship with whatever it was. And this has religious bearings too. Whatever it was that gave them birth, a new relationship to the mystery, a different sort of religious consciousness, no longer that of a dependent infant, but of an active partner. And it's a different sort of creation, therefore it's a conscious world that's being born. These seem to be the underlying suppositions of Jung's psychology, which, as you can guess, has been an enormously important factor in my life. Ours has been, to put it too crudely, not too crudely, for thousands of years, the culture of the cattle raid. That world in which not changed much from the world of Alexander of Macedon, who his first act of prowess in his teenage was to bring back some cattle from the neighbour, and also the neighbour's head. And there are still towers of skulls in the Balkans made of such initiations. The culture went on like that and was enormously resilient, and that is incidentally the explanation of the horror of those late Balkan wars. Because as soon as you took off an imperial authority, first the Turks and then, of course, the communist one, everything broke out right back to its own appalling race roots. And of course, there are plenty of criminal associations in this country, aren't there? And in, no doubt in mine, where that's the same qualification. You have to go out and kill somebody. It doesn't matter who. It's still around. The great empires of Europe, cattle raided all over the world and called it glory. La gloire. The concept of glory from outside that culture is completely incomprehensible. But inside it, you see, a culture is a system of meaning. Inside it, it meant plenty. The point is that the human predator, I think, doesn't mature, doesn't develop. He remains a boy. For to grow up into conscious, have a conscience and consciousness would be to destroy his livelihood. Therefore, it has become very largely a feelingless culture. And it's very difficult to think that you belong to a feelingless culture until you begin to look closely at what happens, in fact, and how little response we have. I think it's very, you know, the way we can read the Iliad and about those the massacres of outside Troy as an entertaining story and not realize what a hideous culture it reflected. It was the heroic culture. Always astonishes me. I mean, it sort of began to shock me, but I... And it is significant that none of those famous heroes of our myth, not Theseus, not Perseus, not Jason, not the god Apollo, who was the model of them all, they all killed monsters, are tremendously brave. They all, I think, used women to get at the monsters, like Theseus, you remember, with Ariadne. Ariadne holds the cord, and he goes into the labyrinth and kills the monster and comes out. And then he leaves Ariadne on an island on the way home. He thinks she'd be an embarrassment if he turned up with her. So he betrays her. And that is the pattern of the hero. Not a single one of them has any doesn't betray love. When the first wave of raiders hit the Neolithic world in the late 4th millennium, the warlords rose. And as soon as happens that, as soon as that happens, of course, they became extremely like the enemy. From military leaders, they turned into kings, hereditary kings. We still see it now. And under that sort of rule, it is as if that sea change passes through society that I've mentioned. The civilization which ended then was the most creative that has ever existed in the Western world. Big claim. But remember, they started from scratch. The historical Gilgamesh ruled in 2700. And was credited with building the Great Wall of Uruk some 3 centuries after the coming of the kings. And the Gilgamesh poem ends with this great sing of praise to the wall. This is the Wall of Uruk, which no city on earth can equal. See how its ramparts gleam like copper in the sun. Climb the stone staircase more ancient than the mind can imagine. Approach the Ayana temple, sacred to Ishtar, a temple that no king has equaled in size or beauty. All heroic stuff, isn't it? walk on the wall of Uruk, follow its course round the city, inspect its mighty foundations, examine the brickwork, how massively it's built, observe the land enclosed, the palm trees and the gardens, the orchards, the glorious palaces, the shops, the marketplaces, the houses, the public squares. 3,000 years on, of course, there are only Iron Age hill forts and things in England. But that, of course, they had lost touch with something very much better. The point is that though the king made the wall, he hadn't made the city. That had been done by unheroic, unaristocratic cooperation of equals, which is where the creative instinct best operates. When the wall was built, it stretched for 6 miles and enclosed an urban area so large that no other city would equal it until the great days of Rome. Within that space, the foundations of all future civilizations of time were laid. The study of the stars, possibly first of all. The measurements of time, which would come from it. The calendar, the clocks. The calendar which we still use today, with a 28-day month, the 7-day quarter month, 28-day moon, 7-day quarter moon, a 13-month year, because there were 13 moons, but that was changed because it was thought too matriarchal after the big change. The 13 then became bad luck, and many other things like that. But the first calendar was certainly a 13-month year. The 60-minute hour, the 60-second minute, also came from there. Sailing ships, the models of sailing ships in tombs as far back as 3,500. The trade with the sister civilization of the Indus, down the Gulf and across, and in the other direction to the Red Sea and up into Egypt, which was not so advanced as Sumer, in fact. Wheel transport, potter's wheel, which greatly increased the production of pottery. And perhaps most characteristically and wonderful and symbolically important, a system of irrigated land as vast and complex as was needed to feed such a huge city. With its locks, its sluice gates, its water wheels, the fine gradations by which water has to be led to flow, the immensely complex system by which it would be justice would be between the various people. Hugely developmental culture, without anybody on top doing it. Working itself out, the most creative possible use of human genius. Aqueducts, accumulated knowledge, of course, of mathematics, feeding into the other mathematics, the astronomy and the navigation and so on. And finally, you see, inevitably out of this, you've got a script developing. It's script for the development of, first of all, of taxation, payments of produce to the temple and that sort of thing. But of course, developing as the needs of the city developed into a poetry, a storytelling capacity, a literature, in fact. And from there we get our news, our information of all the temple rituals. A little bit I gave you yesterday. Extraordinary rituals of the sacred marriage. Extraordinary rituals. But we have it there in writing. Now, all these things, I want to give you, I think, the philosophic, the basis of the sacred marriage before I stop today. All these things are things which nature can't do for herself. They're things for which she needs the human. If she is to give way to a new world which is advanced beyond, as it were, the lovely prairies and forests which she's made herself. She's going to need the human. And that's the basic idea of the sacred marriage between the human and the goddess. The goddess, of course, is the same thing as nature. When we talk about a goddess culture, we mean a nature culture. And it was central to the Neolithic world and to all those fragments which survived it into the post-Neolithic, the patriarchal world, in the various multiple nature religions over the Middle East agricultural lands. The rituals of the birth, espousals, and death of the sun husband of the goddess took many forms throughout the Fertile Crescent, but always essentially the same. And I think I don't know how many years I've puzzled about what that was about, but I don't think I have any doubt now. It was basically from that marriage of the human and earth, a relationship conceived as a marriage with its limits between opposites, with respect and love and above all creativity. In the rite repeated each year in the temples at Uruk, Larsa, Ur, and the other cities of Sumer, she starts off as a virgin, you see. She's in the same virgin state as when she made the world itself, nature itself. But now something new is happening. She calls out to the man the long gestated fruit of her womb, of her son. And we can think of her gestating this human over billions of years as if it's some essence of her nature herself which she wants to get out with all his intelligence and ability for consciousness. And she calls out to him to make her fertile in a new way. It would be the crucial move from unconscious into conscious being, which was, it seems, her plot from the beginning. Must have been. Not mere being, but conscious being. And she sings that lovely little hymn, "My womb, the horn, the boat of heaven," that's the moon I mentioned yesterday, the boat of heaven, "is eager like the young moon. My untilled land lies fallow. Who will plough my womb? Who will plough my high field? Who will plough my wet ground?" And the man who represents the city replies, "Great lady, the king will plough your womb. I, Dumuzi, the king, will plough your high fields. I will plough your ground." He's called Dumuzi, later Tammuz, later Adonis. I think I told you yesterday how Gilgamesh was no way prepared to join this little gang of the lovers, because of course they all die. And there follows, he's called Dumuzi, later Tammuz, later Adonis, and there are echoes of him in the Christ as well. There, by that time, religion has moved into a different mode, and it's not easy to recognize it, but it's certainly there. They are the same figures, and in this ritual, she replies simply, "Then do it, man of my heart, do it." And that, you see, is the beginning of the whole agricultural year. And that follows in the ritual what the later world would feel was shameless. For the split had not begun between nature and the human. They were separate and opposite, but also united. And described in antiphonal hymn form, completely explicit, and with not the slightest trace of the obscene. For as we see so clearly in our culture, it is the damaged instinct that makes the obscene. Incidentally, if you want to see what 5,000 years of patriarchy have done to the beautiful instincts of creation, go to any red light area. We should be appalled and horrified. Again, it's one of those things we take it for granted because we can't feel it. The city around which Gilgamesh built the wall had been centered upon that ritual since its foundation, thousands of years before. It's among the deepest conundrums of the human destiny that the things that make a true civilization, the imagination, philosophy, religion, curiosity, spontaneous creativity, love, the hunger for knowledge for its own sake and no other reason, the delight in the fact of living, all are cobwebs in the face of war and are simply swept away. Well, thank you. Got 5 minutes. Anybody want? Should be now, hello. Yeah. Did you say you agreed or what?
I wasn't quite sure what you
wanted to address. Oh, I see. No, he'd been killing, he'd been hunting well beyond the limits of what was nature considered okay. Well beyond it. He had no sense of the sacredness of nature whatsoever. They had just killed and killed and killed. And then he saw the goddess. And then she turned him into a stag. And then he got hunted. My interpretation is that it was not because he saw her naked, but because he had flagrantly broken the rule of the sacredness. In a way, they're the same thing, of course. Oh, yeah. I think what's so unhappy about that is it's so unerotic. Modern porn is just so unerotic. I don't think it's about love at all, but I don't think it's. I don't know if it bears on the question of censorship or not. You see, don't know whether it does better or not. The trouble is the deeply wounded instinct, which we have to somehow over generations try and heal. I sometimes think that parenting is almost the best thing we can do, or anything to do with children, if you can just bring up some relatively undamaged human beings. It would be the best thing you could do, really.
Can you say that Carl Jung himself quite strongly against this patriarchal kind of society? He believed in the balance.
He was very much the psychologist of nature. And for him, it was the whole centre of things was the male-female pair in absolute equality, because... No, absolutely not, no. And that's why he was so interested in the alchemists who had the same idea. You see, there cannot be a relationship between two people, either at different sex or the same sex, if they're not equal. If you go like that, then there can't be a relationship. It becomes a power thing. Well. Now, I have some approximate copies of this... of this lecture, and I think that Ingrid said that they had printed some more. I don't know. Have you got the second one? Is that the? This is lecture two. Yeah, but only 30 of them or so.